This is Dr. David Mathewson in his teaching on third semester Greek. This is session number 7, additional features and verb tense.
In this lecture, I want to do two things because we're kind of transitioning into verbs, verbal forms. The first thing I want to do is just kind of wrap up some of the things we've done already by, I just want to do some odds and ends that we kind of only touch on or just to add and fill out some of the things we've already said. And then the second thing we'll do is move into verbs, and especially focusing on the verb tense forms and what they communicate. So talking about a few odds and ends, one of the things that we've seen in a couple of examples and that we didn't spend time on with the genitive case is that one of the most common functions of the genitive case in nouns and in pronouns and other noun forms is to demonstrate possession. So again, if I have a noun followed by a noun in the genitive case that modifies it, one of the things that that noun can do in the genitive is express possession. So, and this is one of the more basic common functions of the genitive case. So to use an example, just a really generic, easy example that I've used for a couple of other things, the love of God. Here's your noun in the genitive, that "u" ending that modifies love. In a certain context, the genitive "theu" could simply express possession, the love that belongs to God, God's love. And sometimes you can just use the word "of," the love of God, but God's love to make it clear that possession is what's indicated. And again, the context would be the primary indicator. And we've seen that this construction could mean other things. The love that comes from God, more source, or God is the one doing the loving, more of a subjective genitive. Or if God is the object of our love, the love for God, objective genitive. So there's other ways this can function, but in a certain context, the genitive can express possession, that love that belongs to God. Or you might have, again, to use a very common way of showing possession is a personal pronoun, autos, in the genitive case. So I could have something like doulos autou, his servant, the word in the genitive modifying servant. In the right context, this is probably could be seen as a genitive of possession, the servant belonging to him, his servant. And instead of translating it "servant of him," which would seem rather awkward in English, just translate it "his servant," using a possessive adjective, his, showing possession. So the genitive case is a really one very common function of it in nouns and pronouns, such as personal pronouns, is to show possession. Another kind of odds and ends that I want to wrap up with before we move on to verbs is we've talked in a number of places about adverbial forms. That is, again, the verb modifier container in a sentence. We've seen that, for example, a noun in the accusative case, adverbial accusatives, can fill the container. An adjective sometimes can function as an adverb, but more commonly you'll find an adverb, which are usually fixed forms in Greek, filling the adverb slot. We talked about a number of functions of them. I think we mentioned time. We mentioned extent. Another one would be location. Such as the word hoda, here. Adverbs sometimes can indicate location or where the action of the verb takes place. We could also, another example would be, or another function of the adverb could be frequency. The adverb dies, or twice. He or she did something twice. Twice on the Sabbath, twice a Sabbath. Frequency is a common meaning of the adverb. So this would be true of most, all of these adverb constructions. We'll see that these meanings come up again. For example, we'll see there are other things that can fill the adverb container. Adverbial participles. When we get to that, we will talk about adverbial participles. But just be aware of some of these various functions. The two we've added is location and frequency are very common functions of the adverb. And the adverbs, again, telling us more information about the nature of the verbal action in the sentence and filling in more details. Now, what I want to do then is transition into discussing verbs. And probably the verb is the most semantically significant feature of a sentence. And part of that can be seen in that the endings of verbs indicate at least five features. They indicate tense, or as we're going to argue in a little bit, aspect is probably a better word. Tense, voice, mood, person, and number, whether it's singular or plural. All five of those are indicated, communicated by the verb, and more specifically, by the verb ending. And that's why you spend so much time, when it gets to verbs, you spend so much time memorizing different endings. Every time one of these changes, you get a new set of endings, or you get a new ending. So the verb communicates a lot of information, adds a lot of semantic content to the clause. Verbs kind of indicating the main goings-on in a clause, the main activities, the main actions, the main states that carry and move the discourse forward. So verbs are very important. And what I want to do is in this lecture and perhaps the next one, we'll focus on tense or aspect because that is probably, even of these five, that is probably the most significant feature of the Greek verb, followed probably by mood and then voice and person and number. I mean, they're all important, but some of them seem to carry more weight in what they communicate and what they do in the sentence. And so we'll spend the next couple lectures on tense and then a separate one on voice, person, and number later on. And then in a separate lecture, look at mood and the different moods in the Greek of the New Testament. So let's start with the first one, and that would be tense or aspect. So we're discussing Greek verbs. And the first one, again, would be tense. Or, again, I'm going to argue that a better explanation for what is going on in Greek verbs is what is known as aspect or verbal aspect. Now, especially in languages like English, when we come to the Greek language from an English perspective, English verbs are heavily temporal or tense-oriented. So if I say, I walk, I'm speaking of the present time. If I say, I walked, I'm referring to something I did in the past. And frequently, you know, we want to read the Greek language through that perspective. For a lot of students coming to the Greek language, when their native language is English, coming to Greek language for the first time. And Greek was frequently treated like that. It was often thought that the tense system in Greek was basically just that, a tense system. It was temporal, past, present, and future. So you have in Greek you have an aorist tense, and hopefully this is simply summarizing first-year Greek information. You have an imperfect tense. You have a present, a perfect, and a pluperfect. And then the future tense. And it was often thought that these two communicate past time. That's their main function. And then the present tense communicates present time. The perfect tense, especially, was often seen as a combination of past and present, a past act with ongoing results. And then the pluperfect tense was seen as a past perfect, that is, a past act with ongoing results, all in the past, and then the future tense referring to future time. And so Greek was often seen as a heavily temporal language. And then the other feature that was often thought present in the Greek tense system was the kind of action. Along with the time, was the kind of action. You'll see in some grammars they'll refer to the German word Aktionsart. That's a German word meaning kind or type of action. And it was often thought that the use of the tense reflected the kind of action that was actually going on. So, for example, the aorist tense is often described as a punctiliar tense form. It indicates time, action that took place in the past, but punctiliar. Sometimes you'll find, especially older works, referring to instantaneous action, once for all, action that was done and finished and over with, completed action, it was all finished and done with, done in an instant. You often find that description of the aorist. The imperfect tense was also past time, but it indicated ongoing or durative action. In contrast to the aorist that was point or punctiliar, the imperfect indicated durative or action that took place over a period of time. Then the present tense, the time of it was present time. It was taking place during the time of the writing, during the time that the author is writing from the author's perspective. But the kind of action was ongoing or durative. And you often would find, and you still do find things like the present tense means that the action, it's still going on or it took place. It's habitual. It takes place over a long period of time. It's durative. The duration of the action is over a longer period of time. Then the perfect tense and pluperfect tense were kind of a combination of past and present. So the perfect tense was a past punctiliar, some even described it as a combination of the aorist and the present, a past punctiliar action that's finished, but the results are durative and ongoing into the present. And then the future tense is often seen the time, obviously future. It hasn't taken place. From the perspective of the author, the action hasn't taken place. And often the kind of action is seen as punctiliar, like the aorist tense. So that's a fairly standard common way of treating the verb tenses in Greek from the standpoint of both time and kind of action. Now, recently, there has been a kind of a change or a shift, a major shift, in the way that we understand the Greek verb tense endings. And just to let you know, as far as language and labels are going to use, if I use the word tense, I'm referring not to time when I'm referring to Greek verbs, but to the endings, the tense endings. So all those endings you memorize, o, ace, a, amen, eta, usi, o, my, a, atai, on, s, a, amen, eta, on, etc. Those are the tense endings. But I distinguish that from what they communicate. And I'm suggesting that what the tense endings of Greek verbs indicate is primarily aspect. And what aspect means is simply, aspect has to do with how the author chooses to view the action, the author's perspective on the action. Irrespective of when it took place, or even how it took place. So those notions, time and kind of action, those are both present in the Greek language, but they're indicated by the context, not the endings of the verbs. The endings of the verbs, I would argue, indicate aspect or verbal aspect. And that is, the Greek verb endings indicate how the author chooses to look at and view the action. And kind of the simple opposition is this. Does the author simply look at the action as a whole, whether it was instantaneous, whether it was a long duration, whether it was repeated, does the author just look at the whole thing and say, there it is, it happened? Or does the author choose to look at the action as it unfolds and develops, whether it's a short duration, whether it's repeated, or of long duration? Does the author choose to kind of enter the action and see it as it develops and unfolds? Those are two aspects. In a limited way, we can do this in English. So think of this example. I studied in the library last night for 2 hours. Or, I was studying in the library last night. And, you know, for the same 2 hour period. I'm referring to the same act, the same period of time. Yet, what's the difference between saying I studied and I was studying? One of them simply just summarizes it. I studied, without saying anything more. I was studying looks at it as an action unfolding and developing. It's the same action, just two different aspects or two different perspectives on that action, two different ways of viewing it. And that's kind of what Greek does by its endings. By choosing an ending, the author portrays a specific action or a specific aspect or perspective on the action, a specific way of viewing the action. And the point is, the same action can often be viewed from different perspectives. You can use the same tense you can use different tenses to describe the same action depending on your perspective. A good example in the New Testament is the resurrection of Jesus Christ is referred to with three different tenses throughout Paul's letters. Sometimes, more frequently, it's in the aorist tense. We'll talk about what these tenses are. But you find it referred to in the perfect tense, for example, in 1 Corinthians 15. And one place, it's referred to with the present tense. Did Christ raise three times? No, it's the same resurrection. Just depending on his perspective, Paul can use different tenses. One common visual metaphor that's often been used is maybe overused sometimes is an image of a parade and a helicopter. So if there's a parade going on 4th of July, since that was the most recent holiday, I believe, if you have a 4th of the July parade and it lasts for 2 hours, we'll say, if I'm in a helicopter above the parade and just looking at the whole thing, that would be one perspective. And we'll see that's similar to the aorist tense in Greek. We'll talk more about that in a moment. But what if I'm on the street corner watching this parade develop and unfold in front of me? It's the same parade. It goes on for the same period of time, yet now it's a more close-up view. I'm seeing it go on and develop and unfold. Or what if I'm the parade manager? I'm looking at the parade as all the conditions, all the planning, everything coming into existence, into the result, the seeing the parade as a state of affairs that results from all the preparation and planning and all the conditions. That would be similar. That would be another perspective, similar to the perfect tense form in Greek. So the same parade, but different ways of looking at it. And that's, I think, a helpful way of understanding verbal aspect in Greek, is that the choice of an ending, all the tense forms that you learned in first year Greek, aorist, imperfect, present, perfect, pluperfect, which is rare, but there's a few forms, and then future, all of... We'll talk about the future form later. Most agree that that's not a true aspect. We'll set that aside for a moment and return to that. But the present, the aorist, the imperfect, the perfect, pluperfect, those are all different ways of viewing different perspectives on the action. And a lot of times, again, the exact same action can be viewed from different perspectives. You can find, for example, when you look at the Gospels, sometimes it'll say, and Jesus said this, using an aorist tense for said. But another Gospel recording the same speech will have the present tense, Jesus said, using a present. Instead of apon, the aorist, it'll have lege, he said. What's the difference? It's not a different speech, it's the same speech. It's a different way of portraying the action. Whether you just want to summarize it, Jesus said, or whether you want to look at it as a process that was developing or unfolding. So that's kind of a rough introduction to verbal aspect. And again, a grammar such as the one that Professor Emig and I wrote on intermediate Greek grammar for Baker Publishing. Intermediate Greek, we have a chapter that introduces you to verbal aspect. Another really good introduction is found in the Idioms of New Testament Greek by Stan Porter. One of his introductory chapters, I think it's chapter 1 or 2, has a treatment of verbal aspect. And you'll find all kinds of resources to the present day on verbal aspect. And some of them differ from each other, but the primary idea is that most people agree that the primary feature of Greek verbs is not time or kind of action, but verbal aspect, how the author chooses to represent the action. Whether the author wants to represent the action as a complete whole, or whether the author wants to represent the action as developing or unfolding, or whether the author wants to represent the action as a state of affairs, an existing state. The same action can be viewed from those three different perspectives, represented by the choice of a Greek verb tense form, whether aorist or present or imperfect or perfect tense. So that's kind of what verbal aspect is. And again, usually the author has a choice. Some verbs, for example, the verb ame, the author doesn't have, it doesn't have basically perfect tense forms. It doesn't have aorist tense forms. The author's basically limited to the present and the imperfect tense when it comes to using ame. So some verbs are restricted, but many verbs have a choice. The author can choose how he wants to view the action by the choice of a tense form. So that's kind of what verbal aspect is, and again, I think it's important to grasp. What I want to do now is just two additional things. I want to just kind of summarize. In the next lecture, we'll look more specifically at the tense forms or the aspects and their meanings and how they can function. But I simply want to summarize kind of the meanings of the aspects in New Testament Greek and then talk just briefly about, well, how do they function? Why would the author choose a certain aspect? So when it comes to the aspects, the first one that I want to talk about is the aorist tense form. And the aorist tense form is basically, this is basically the summary tense. It just looks at the action as a complete whole. This would correspond to the helicopter. Just, it doesn't matter how long the action went on. It doesn't matter whether it was repeated or not. It doesn't matter whether it's going to happen again. It doesn't matter whether it was of short, instantaneous duration. The aorist tense just looks at the whole thing and summarizes it. It looks at the action as a complete whole. Let me change that to the present tense. By contrast, the present tense looks at the action as developing or unfolding. Again, it doesn't tell you how long the action took place. Only the context can do that. Whether the action took place over a long period of time, whether it was repeated, whether it was of shorter duration, the present tense just says the author looks at the action as it develops and unfolds. My colleague that I wrote the grammar with, Elodie Emig, she suggested the image of a snow globe. And she said, when you shake a snow globe, if you've ever seen one of those little snow globes, you shake it, and especially those ones that have a little man or a little figure, a woman inside of it. She said the present tense, the aorist tense is if I shake the snow globe and put it down and I look at it from outside, that's the aorist. I just see the whole thing. But if I'm that little figure inside the snow globe, I see the snow falling, I see it as it develops and unfolds. The present tense is a more close-up, a more internal view of how the action develops and unfolds. The imperfect tense form has the exact same aspect as the present. It looks at the action as developing or unfolding, as the perspective more internal, seeing it as it unfolds. So what's the difference between the present and the imperfect? The imperfect also communicates the feature of remoteness. And by that, we don't mean remote necessarily for physical distance, but more remote in perspective or from the author's standpoint. If I were to use the parade illustration, it might be that I'm still down on the street watching the parade, but maybe I'm back a block, and it's not quite so close up. It's a little bit more remote in perspective. And that's why not all the time, but you often do see the imperfect tense used, especially in narrative of past time. And that's due to the remote perspective. But wherever the imperfect is used, it communicates the same aspect as the present. Action seen as ongoing or developing, unfolding. But with the additional feature of the action is seen from a slightly more remote perspective. Then the perfect and pluperfect tense forms. Fortunately, the pluperfect tense, I don't know if I want to say fortunately, but the endings are rather, they're actually easy to spot because it's so bulky, how the pluperfect is formed. You can go back and look at your first year grammars and see how they're formed, but the pluperfect tense form is basically dying out in the New Testament, and it's being communicated by other means that we can look at later. But it's still there. But generally, you're responsible for these four aspects for the most part. The perfect tense form then basically views an action as an existing state, as a state of affairs. Sometimes it's as the result of a past action, but not always. A classic example of that is the Greek verb oida, I know. And the idea is, I am in a state of knowing. There's no necessary emphasis on a past act that brought that out. Or in 1 Corinthians 15, when it says Jesus was raised, he was crucified and buried and raised on the third day. That verb raised is in the perfect tense. The emphasis on he was in the state of being raised. His resurrection was seen as an existing state. So the perfect tense form looks at the action as an existing state, a state of affairs. Whether that action is past or present, the context can only tell you that. All the perfect tense does is suggest that the action is seen as a state, an existing state. And then the pluperfect, basically, if you follow this, the pluperfect is to the perfect what the imperfect is to the present. That is, it shares the same aspect, state of affairs, but it adds the feature of remoteness. And it basically is exclusively used in pastime context because of its meaning and the notion of remoteness. But again, the pluperfect is to the perfect what the imperfect is to the present. That is, they share the present and perfect share the same aspect. The imperfect adds a feature of remoteness. Perfect and pluperfect share the same aspect. The pluperfect, like the imperfect, adds the feature of remoteness. So those are the basic meanings of the tense forms and the aspects. Again, the tense forms are the endings. The aspect is the meaning communicated by those. In the next lecture, we'll look at a little bit more detail at the meaning of these tense forms or these aspects. But the last thing I want to do is ask the question: well, why the different aspects? And we'll later on look at an example of what I'm about to communicate to you. But I don't want to say that this is always the case. But one of the things that aspect can do. You know, when you're reading a text in the New Testament and you see, especially when the author uses different aspects, a good example is read through sections of Revelation sometime and notice how the author shifts. You know, he'll use the aorist, and then there's present tenses, and then there's imperfect tense, and then there's a perfect tense thrown in, then back to aorist, and then more presents. And the author's shifting on, you know, what in the world is going on? Well, one of the things that aspect can do is the author can use it to structure the discourse, and that is to show levels of prominence, to attach more importance to certain things. And again, I would not say that verbal aspect always does this, but it often does, and it's worth noting, and it's worth looking and considering examining verbal aspect from this perspective. So often discourse can have at least these two features, particularly narrative, but one of them is background. That is, certain actions in a discourse will serve, it's still important, but it'll function more at a background level. It'll communicate supporting feature, it'll communicate necessary, but more background feature. And then the foreground in a discourse would be more salient information, more important information. Like if you've ever watched a movie in 3D, you know, certain events are, you know, used to be able to get those 3D glasses and watch certain movies. And, you know, certain events are going on in the background. They're necessary for the story to work. But then main characters or main events are in the foreground. They kind of stick out at you. Verbal aspect can do that. For example, the aorist and imperfect tense forms tend to indicate background information. And again, we'll look at some examples of this when we get to discuss in more detail, especially in the last lecture when we talk about discourse considerations. We'll look at some examples, but even as we discuss in the next lecture in more detail the verbal aspect, we'll look at some examples. But the aorist and the imperfect tense forms tend to, in discourse, often indicate background information. Again, that does not mean unimportant or you can ignore it. It just has to do with how does it function in the discourse. Background information is important, but it just serves a supporting role, a background role. Whereas foreground will often be indicated by the present tense and the perfect tense forms. And I would say also, we'll talk about this later, the future tense forms. Those can often indicate foreground or prominent information, information that's meant to stick out in the discourse, to kind of be like a peak in the discourse. Now, there's other things. There's other things in Greek that can indicate background and foreground besides verbal aspect. I'm just saying that's one of the things that verbal aspect can do. And that's one of the reasons why authors can shift in aspect. So in the Gospels, you often find the author narrating with the aorist tense, and all of a sudden he'll throw a present tense in, even though he's still talking about past time. That's meant to foreground. So keep this in mind, that one of the things, and I would say it does happen frequently, not all the time, and that's not the meaning. Background and foreground are not the meaning of the verbal aspects. It's just one of the ways they can often function. But the background information can often be indicated by the aorist and the imperfect tense, and then foreground information, especially by the present tense and the perfect tense form, and sometimes the future as well. So that's one of the ways a verbal aspect can function. Again, that gets you away from pin the label on the grammatical construction, but getting you to look at the whole discourse and note patterns. Of, you know, where do you see aorist tenses and imperfects? Where do you see present tenses? Can you explain what they're doing? Can you explain why they're there? Are they meant to indicate background and foreground information? So in the next lecture, we'll spend a little bit more time looking at more detail at the individual aspects and their meanings and how they can function.
This is Dr. David Mathewson in his teaching on third semester Greek. This is session number 7, additional features and verb tense.